You basically want to ask the relay for a block as late as possible, right? And so I think here there's a few components we've looked at. One is we have a forked Web Boost version, which we call it Archer, which allows us to introduce this type of strategic latency. But then I think beyond that, it's a lot about understanding how different client implementations work.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, GM, everyone. My name's Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I'm with Michael from Chorus One. How's it going?
Hey, all good. Thanks for having me.
Sweet. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate the time. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you or Chorus One, what do you do?
Yeah, sure. So Chorus One is a validator. We have around 4 billion in stake. Mostly, I think Ethereum is our biggest network, but we do have a large footprint on Cosmos as well. We have like 52 chains overall, and I think probably around 3/4 of those would be Cosmos chains. So that's an ecosystem that we are fairly big into. We also have a decent footprint on Solana. So we were there quite early, and we also developed some things like the Solana MEV client that I'm happy to go into. I'm currently head of research at Chorus. Mostly spent my time on the MEV from a validator peer view. I think that's just about it.
How did you get into all this? What's your background and how did you find yourself at Chorus One?
So my background is pretty colorful. I originally found Bitcoin in, I think it was 2013, back then on the Less Wrong forums. And I decided to try mining it. Back then, the easiest way of doing it was to run the Slush Pool client. So I basically had like the student gaming PC. I downloaded the Slush Pool client and had that run for a while. But it was actually already a lot more difficult back then than people would typically think. So I got like, you know, a fraction of a Bitcoin out of it. And then kind of moved away from crypto for a while. So finished my university degree. I worked in finance a bit and then also worked in an embassy.
What were you doing at the embassy?
Basically, the background is, okay, so I started working in finance and they are already kind of blockchain adjacent. And then somebody known asked me that there was like an open position in the embassy in like the cultural track, right? So basically something that would be attached to the cultural attaché. And that sounded interesting to me. So I went for it for around 2 years. And then COVID hit. And that whole thing fell flat because there were no more events. And that's when I started to get back into kind of MEV is what pulled me back in. So I did some trading and I found that back, you know, in 2021, that was still fairly accessible. So I did that for around 2 years. But then the markets got a lot harder and it didn't really make sense to continue that as a one-man operation. And that's when I joined Chorus One.
Okay. And when you were doing MEV, do you have any stories from the before or four times under pre-PBS? And were you doing pre-PBS or what was it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of started doing it a little bit pre-PBS, but originally the first time I experimented with MEV was around 2017. And this was a very different Ethereum because you could still run an order book on the L1. So those of your listeners that had been around back then would probably remember EDEX and EtherDelta, which were kind of the two big order book DEXs on Ethereum. And so I kind of traded on them. But then I noticed that there was a pretty big price discrepancy, right? So it was just a totally inefficient market. And I thought, like, maybe that's not quite right. I got to try that out if there's actual price discrepancy. And I found out that you could actually trade EDEX, for example, versus KuCoin manually you could arbitrage it manually. Exactly. It was like a completely different universe back then. And you could come out with a, you know, a profit, which is not super significant, but it's enough to, you know, it's like, it answers the binary question that there is a price discrepancy that can't be traded, right? And so I coded that up and I was arbitraging that for a while. And then, I mean, there's this old cliche, right? I mean, if you start running arbitrage between order books, at some point, start off as a taker or something, but then you become a maker. And then at some point, as you become more sophisticated about pushing your limit order when you want it to be, you kind of slip into like a makeshift market making operation. So yeah, I did it for a while. I mean, profit wise, it was pretty unimpressive, but back then it was a very fun game to play.
Definitely. And then you found yourself in Chorus One. And were you doing the Solana side of Chorus One at this time? I know you guys did an MEV validator, which is very in tune with your validator MEV.
Yeah.
But you say you have a lot of stake in Ethereum as well on the validation side. So how are you finding MEV on Ethereum relative to Solana? And why are you in Cosmos as well?
Yeah. So we kind of had three arenas, if you will, for our MEV work. One was Cosmos, specifically Osmosis. The other was Solana and then Ethereum. And I'll just quickly talk about the Cosmos part of it, because that's what we didn't end up pursuing, right? So that's like a pretty quick episode. Back around 2 years ago, there was a fair amount of trading activity on Osmosis, but MEV really wasn't something that people were aware of, right? I mean, that wasn't something that would have caught, you know, would have had a lot of attention. So we thought that this is maybe something that we can try. And I think here it's important to take a step back, right? I mean, what do we do as a firm? We are foremost a validator. But then as a validator, your business case really is about being visible in the ecosystem, right? I mean, you kind of want people to know about you, and you want people to know that you know what you're doing and that you have some technical background that's respectable. And a good way of doing it is just to have these projects which kind of demonstrate. So we managed to hit some triangle arbitrage on Osmosis, then decided not to pursue it because we weren't quite sure where to go with it. And then shortly after, Skip deployed ProtoRef on Osmosis, that you may be aware of, right? It's basically in protocol MEV. And then we kind of let Cosmos be for the time being. I think we might come back to it, or we did come back to it, because we had a grant for DYDX, which is another story. And then on the Solana side of things, which was what we focused on immediately after, that was pre-Cheeto, right? So there was no real well-defined approach to MEV on Solana. What happened back then is there would just be a lot of spam, which basically, it seems like some things don't change. But yeah, we thought about what could be a good way of addressing this. And I think we took some inspiration from what Skip did with Osmosis there. And we decided to fork the Solana client that basically includes some basic triangle arbitrage with it, which, you know, we thought would have been, like, if you look at from first principles, a good way of addressing MEV on Solana, because then it goes back to stakers and validators run on social consensus. So, you know, there's a lot of incentives for people to behave well and not run sandwich attacks, this type of stuff. And we put it out there. I mean, it's on our repo, but we ended up not running it in the longer term, A, because Cheeto came about, and B, just because there was a lot of maintenance. And it was open source, but we didn't see as much contributions as we might have wished for. And then with Ethereum, I mean, that's actually an interesting story. We basically had like nodes deployed in different data centers around the globe. And the reason for that is just a redundancy case, like risk management. And what we noticed is that our validators that were deployed in Asia, in expectation, earned higher MEV rewards than our validators that were based in Europe or the US. And so that was kind of weird. And we didn't really understand what to do with it. So we waited for a while and we ran some stats on it. But then it seemed like, you know, the statistical difference there was really quite significant. And then we started thinking about what the differences are. And it turns out that the main difference is just latency, right? Because most relays were deployed. I mean, most performant relay back then was ultrasound, and that was deployed in Frankfurt. We're deployed in EU West or US East. Yeah. So that additional latency led to the slight upside of rewards. And that's how we found timing games, that this is what we would spend most of our time on at the moment, yeah.
Okay. So the timing games were based on the relays. Why didn't you guys ever go into a block building if you actually deployed a relay?
We didn't have a relay, right? We just had the validator nodes.
Oh, you were just seeing the
Exactly. We were just tracking basically the way we interact with relays, and that's how we found out that the Asia nodes tend to earn higher rewards because of that additional latency to the relay. And then as far as block building goes, I mean, here I think block building is a very different game to play from what we usually do. I mean, for one, there's the whole BD component around getting order flow and so on. And I don't think we would be set up for that. And then on the other side of things, I mean, we are, of course, a large team of around 80 people now, but the research team is small. And we are the people that focus on MEV. There's 2 to 3 of us, depending on what people do at the moment. So we weren't set up to run an operation with, you know, the amount of ambition you need to be a good block builder.
And how come you never went into the relay game?
So we looked a little bit at the at relay cost structures. And right. Back then, the number that was floating around is it's around 100K a year. Okay. I mean, we never did an independent analysis of that, but the information we took away is it's expensive. And so then, you know, we do have a significant footprint on Ethereum, but if you look at it from a network perspective, we have like 2% of the world, right? And right. so that, you know, the upside we have is basically capped with the size of our validator operation. This would be too small to make the financial case for the relay.
Okay, interesting. So then what about block builders and relays? Because we just saw, not just saw, but like quite recently, we saw Titan deploy a relay and then open sourced it. Why do you think they would do that?
Yeah, I mean, so we were actually our launch partner for the Titan Relay. We tested it out. Yeah, we tested it out for, I think it was like 1.5-2 months before it became like public. And I mean, here, let me just start this off by saying that the Titan Relay is very good. I've tweeted about this as well, but it's just a very nice piece of software. And that's one thing we see reflected in our operation. You know, at this stage, a lot of our blocks come via the Titan Relay. And also, like something like the audit of the relay is a pretty good read, right? I mean, I just think it's a really solid implementation. Then as far as why block builders would build relays, you know, a builder probably would have a strong opinion on this. One thing that comes to mind for me is if you have the leading relay, I mean, you know, your competitors kind of have to set your blocks. And so I think if you look at the game theory of the like of the bid you put in, having this additional information is probably good. Also, I mean, I guess it, you know, gives you some flexibility in slots where you really want to. Yeah, I'm not sure how that works in practice, but I guess it just gives you a fair amount of structural advantage in terms of seeing other people's bids earlier than you usually would, and understanding very well, you know, the way the relay would interact with your infrastructure, right? And of course, you're co-deployed as well automatically, and that probably doesn't hurt you.
Yeah, that's the main thing, I think, as well. It's like the information you get from this would be the value, not really any financial gain, but that information contributes to financial gain in the builder or something else. But couldn't people just send to a different relay though?
You mean other builders? Like in that case?
Yeah, if I was a builder and I was like, oh, I knew this about the Titan relay, how it's connected to their one, then I would just not send it to them. But like, what's the detriment of that?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I'm sure that people will submit to like a broad range of relays. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The thing with the Titan relay is, for us, one thing we've noticed is, you know, when you ask the Titan relay for a blocker, you ask it for a payload, it just responds very quickly. And so for that reason, I feel like Titan Relay probably just critically has a higher chance of getting your best bid to the validator faster than other relays. And I think that's the reason why people would use it, right? I guess it's a cost-benefit calculation. But at the end of the day, you know, I mean, if the relay is technically better, that definitely counts for something. And then I think the other aspect is Titan is neutral, right? And I'm sure neutrality commitment helps. I'm actually not sure. Do you remember the Manta builder back in the day?
I remember the name, yeah. I think I shut down, right?
They shut down. Yeah, Manta used to be Chain Streets Builder, I think, as everybody knows.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not sure if they ran their own relay or not, but if they definitely only built blocks with their own transactions, right? Yeah, so that seemed kind of adjacent. But yeah, I guess with the Titan relay, it's just the best software.
Right, but then if I was someone that was competitor as a block builder, and even though they're neutral, they would still get enough data to the point where they could reverse engineer like the code or the strategies that I'm using. So, but then at that point, yeah, as you said, you could retrieve information a lot faster, but then you could send it off to some other builder instead. I mean, some other relay instead.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting what you mentioned about information. We have a paper out on timing games, and it basically starts off with, you know, like ABV. Whether a builder wins the auction or not, it's all about information. I guess the way I would measure how big the information leakage is for other builders via the Titan relay is by just waiting for like a few months and seeing if they launch their own relays. Yeah, I think that might happen, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think Beaver is building one right now because they've realized this. And then it's just going to be the bigger zero-sum game of who can have the most infrastructure, optimize it the most. What is your experience with optimizing infrastructure? I know you do a lot of research on the validators, so I think this comes perfectly into Solana, the Solana validator you guys did with the MEV. How did you build that? Because that's a faster game than Ethereum. I think it's 400 milliseconds, the block times, relative to Ethereum's 13, I believe.
Yeah, but that's not right.
So you've got to be a whole lot faster to calculate everything. And the smart contracts aren't the same. Having state is actually just its own contract. Well, what you say, a program. It's not all, you know, you can't have like 20 variables in a single contract, just like Solana, Ethereum. Each one of these pieces of states are in a different contract. So 20 different contracts you have to query. How did you optimize for the 400 millisecond block time, now 200 millisecond? Because Jito, to the Jito auctions, how did that all work? And how would you even optimize it further?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, we've looked into optimization fairly deeply, both on Ethereum and on Solana. I'm a little bit less familiar with Solana, but I think there's some things that are probably interesting. I mean, first still on the Ethereum side of things. Yeah, it's true. The block time is kind of slow. But with something like the timing games, you still have to be very latency aware, because you basically want to ask the relay for a block as late as possible, right? And so I think here, you know, there's a few components we've looked at. One is we have a forked MEV boost version, which we call Adagio, which allows us to introduce this type of strategic latency. But then I think beyond that, it's a lot about understanding how different client implementations work. I mean, you know, like one piece of alpha that might be interesting to share is like even the standard settings for some of these clients, right? It depends like how many peers you pair with out of the box, and then how many like mesh peers you have, how many persistent peers you have, and kind of how performant those are and so on. So there's a lot of nuance there. And then there's also, you know, about how just where does your box sit in terms of the network, right? I mean, it's what I mentioned with the Asia example before. Yeah, and then on the Solana side of things, Solana is definitely a different beast, right? And as you said, block time 400 milliseconds versus 12 seconds for Ethereum. And back when we spent more time with Solana, that was before Jito was deployed, right? So back then, you know, as a validator, you just got spammed with MEV type transactions to the point where our data center actually blocked our machine off a couple of times. So, that DDoS protection just went crazy on us, right? Yeah. So we had to relocate out of one data center altogether because they were just unhappy with us using this amount of bandwidth on the regular. And so that's what, you know, led us to think about, is there a better way of handling MEV, which doesn't feature all of this kind of wasted transactions and the network capacity and so on.
Yeah, it seems like the opposite on Ethereum. You have like a drought of transactions because everyone's competing for it. And then on Solana, you have too many.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Solana is just a fire hose, right? The second you go online with the client, I mean, you just get spammed a lot. And we actually kind of, I mean, you know, we kind of, when we started on Solana, that was back when Solana was first deployed, we wanted to test that. Things were, of course, a lot, I mean, that there wasn't a lot of transaction volume and so on. And then it got us a few times just because Solana popularity shot up so quickly that basically the transaction volume just also increases this kind of geometric curve. And yeah, we had a couple of instances where we needed to upgrade. So we kind of looked at the numbers, right? What are some of the juicy MEV opportunities out there? And then the lowest hanging fruit and the logical point to start was basically triangular arbitrage. So what we did is we looked at the way Solana processes transactions. And we have a paper out on this, by the way, that, you know, maybe people will find it interesting. It's called Breaking Bots. And because the idea was that it would finally rid us of all of this spam, right? So the way the Solana client works is, you know, transactions come in, then they are processed in like a parallelized manner. And then afterwards, you basically have like the payload, whatever. And our fork comes in after the parallelization stage. It basically has some heuristics which just check, okay, you know, what contract does it interact, you know, does it interact with Jupiter or whatever, and back runs it. And I mean, it took some time to get the implementation right to where it can work live, but yeah, it ended up working quite well. But these days it's a bit outdated. So, I mean, we talked about this before, right? It would need quite some work to be deployed again.
Yeah, Olio, I don't think you're compatible with the Jitter bundles either, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was the other point. It was like a good revenue upside before Cheeto came about. But now with Cheeto, it's not competitive anymore because it just runs a subset of strategies. And then kind of covering, you know, the whole universe of tail end MEV and so on. You can't really do that in client. It would be way too much overhead. Yeah. It would be way too much time as well, just in terms of that type of overhead. So Cheeto, just by virtue of being able to cover, you know, it's like some weird protocol getting hacked and there just being a lot of MEV to be captured. You know, we wouldn't be able to do this. And that's the reason why we've retired it as well.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to break into the Solana one just because like the preparation to even do MEV is just so much. Whereas like Ethereum, you can get spun up pretty quickly. It just is an infrastructure problem at that point. For the timing games, I want to go back to that because you did write a paper on this, which I read. The cost of artificial latency on the PBS context, in the PBS context, which basically looked at like the latency of everything. It was quite interesting because as the title says, you can introduce artificial latency into your relay for when people are pinging you. And so you can kind of game the system by giving yourself no latency and other people latency, but then being able to, you know, see their bids, which is where those bidding games comes from. One thing I've always thought about is if you just make, you mentioned like information is actually the biggest player in this, I believe, if I'm reciting that correctly. But if you make such a great block out of all this private order flow and you just order in such a great way that you have so much profit, you know, you don't even need to bid like auction at that point. You just do one big bid and then someone else, like everyone else that doesn't have as good a block as you, they just can't bid above that. So you just price them out instantly. Have you ever encountered any of this when looking at this stuff?
So first of all, yeah, the paper, I think our title's got a lot worse since Breaking Bots. We kind of went from Breaking Bots to the cost of artificial latency in PBS context now that you say it. I think it depends a lot on the market. We definitely see different builder behavior depending on price volatility. But there was also that recent paper, I think, by like a Princeton team or a Stanford team that visualized the auction quite nicely. And yeah, and then in general, our observation is if there's not much volatility, you know, the chance that Titan is going to have the winning block is very high. And then if there's a lot of volatility, I mean, you know, it's like Wintermute, RSync or Beaver. So yeah, I think if there's not a lot of volatility, you definitely see situations where people just have one bid and nobody else really wants to compete with it. Maybe some niche builder, right? Because if you want to make your name as a builder, a good time to subsidize blocks is when there is not a lot of volatility, because it's so much cheaper. But in general, there's definitely situations where there's just one bid out there and then others don't really compete much with it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's even that much competition. With, there's only three people. There's Wintermute, Titan, and Beaver. I don't know if there's any more since I last checked, but it seems like, it's just really Beaver versus Wintermute and then Titan in their own kind of realm, which is now becoming the infrastructure player of everything.
I mean, right, everybody else is very much behind the top three. I think there are some teams that, started getting into it. For example, I think the Penguin Builder had like a mid-single-digit percentage for a while. They were doing a ton of subsidies. And then again, if you don't have private order flow, it's probably quite late in the game to join now.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, there's so much money in it, but the overhead and plus it's a zero-sum game, it's always just a better, I think, choice to play a positive sum. Because even when you lose, you can still win, just given enough time, and which is what basically every protocol does. You just kind of, you can lose for a while, then eventually you just win at some point. You get some investment money, gain some traction, bull market hits, then you just start to win. Whereas, like, if you're playing a zero sum, it's just you lose until you win, and you might not win, so you just lose permanently.
Yeah.
And then all that time's gone.
I know you used to do some MEV as well. It definitely is very easy to get roped into zero sum games, right? I mean, at the beginning, it's definitely always quite fun.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And then the deeper you go, it's still interesting, but it just comes back to the infrastructure. Because even if you have the best strategies, like Jared, for example, he has crazy strategies, but then he just partners with, the people that have the infrastructure, and then it's just that whole kind of game. Because the infrastructure people can even just, like, filter you out. If they're getting 50% of blocks, right, then you just can get censored half the time, and you might even not land your strat just because, I don't know, maybe you're not friends with them. But, like, the game theory effects from that anyway. People will just stop sending you, I believe. But you never know until you see it. It's all just theory. The artificial latency is quite interesting. Can you talk more about that for the people that haven't seen the paper?
So basically, PBS, as I'm sure people know, you kind of have these three big categories of actors. You have builders, you have relays, and then you have the validator, which sits downstream. And now the idea is the validator is basically the intent is that the validator should be a maximally neutral piece of infrastructure, right? And then the reason why we have PBS in the first place is because people wanted to, or the EA specifically wanted to avoid a situation where certain validators do way better than other validators and then kind of manifest the centralization vector. I think there was one, analogous situation to that back when proof of work was still around, which was just Ethermine. I think used to do a fair amount of searching, right? And so the idea behind it is, of course, quite commendable. But then one thing we find is that just returns on centralization, just from a first principle perspective, always kind of manifest in some way, right? And the way in the PBS setup that it manifests on the validator side of things is that the later you ask the relay for a block, so basically the further you go into your slot or the later you end up then proposing your block, the more valuable the MEV component of your block is going to be an expectation. And right. there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is just, the later it is in the slot, the more transaction the builder has available. So kind of the rhetorical space is larger. And there's another reason, which is that the later you are at the slot, the more likely statistical arbitrageurs are to trade, quite broadly because they don't have to sit on the inventory risk. So if you were to graph out the value of a block at the slot progresses, there's a graph in our paper, but in any case, it's a straight line up, and then you have certain jumps, right? Which is basically when statistical arbitrageurs would expect a validator to ask for a block, so they try to get in as late as possible to make sure that they're not sitting on the inventory risk longer than they have to. And then, of course, also the builder algorithm kind of runs for a longer time, right? And so the upshot of all of that is, as the validator, you can be strategic about it, and you can introduce artificial latency, which makes you ask for the block a lot later than you ordinarily would. And then what happens is you earn more. But of course, you know, that doesn't manifest out of nowhere. It basically comes out of the budget of the next validator. And so this is the reason why we wrote the paper, right? I mean, our one perspective is, okay, I mean, we have to compete. And then again, I think, you know, decentralized system has to be robust to this type of incentive. So kind of, you know, if we were to keep our head like in the sand here and ignore it, I don't think it would help anybody. It definitely would make the system more mature. So we decided to do it as good as we can, but at the same time to publish, you know, some of our observations and hope that that helps make the protocol more resilient.
Okay. Interesting. And with the validation of Ethereum, is there even ways to modify where you gain an advantage over other validators? Because I know on Solana, you can with the voting mechanism. So the better you can vote, the more rewards you get for being the validator. But can you do that with Ethereum validator as well?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, what you mentioned about Solana is interesting. We can talk about this later if you want. I feel like there might be an equivalence to that in Cosmos as well, just because of a quirk of Tendermint. But coming back to Ethereum, yeah, there's basically two dials you can turn. Say you have two revenue sources, right? If you just look at it from an eagle eye perspective, one is your attestation and the other is the rewards that you get in the instances that you are the block proposer as the validator. And then in the block proposer case, what you can do is what I just mentioned, that's that whole timing games thing. Okay. And that works quite well. We will actually come out with a dashboard quite soon, which shows our perspective on the org channel. And it basically, you know, shows how much more we made by introducing this delay versus what the earlier bid would have been that we would have taken without the delay. So that's coming. And then on the attestation side of things, it basically comes down to being in a good spot in terms of like the network topology, if you will, right? So you have to make sure that you see the block as early as possible, because then the machine has to run checks on it and so on, and you want to have your signature on there on time. And then the way to do this is to basically look at who your peers are in terms of the network and make sure that you're paired with good peers. But then another thing you can do is you can also use, you know, services like Chainbound, for example. It's a great team that we invested in. I think you talked to them.
Yeah.
They have a solution for that as well, which optimizes validator network connections and can help with attestation rewards. Or Bloxroute is the other team, right? So I think those are the two things that you can do for Ethereum.
Mm. You mentioned the Cosmos, which is relative to very, very similar to the Solana voting. What was that?
Yeah, so I mean, Cosmos is interesting. Well, first of all, so Cosmos is kind of, right, I mean, people say it's a stack, right? I mean, there's the Cosmos SDK and then there's Tendermint consensus algorithm. And cool. Tendermint has been around for a really long time. It's basically been the first proof of stake system that's been put into practice, I think in 2017 or so, but I'm not sure. And what that means is that the P2P implementation that Tendermint runs is basically a decade old at this point, almost, right? And so that means that there's also certain returns on sophistication that you can get, right? So for example, Tendermint features something called a pre-commit, which before you end up proposing your block, you basically, you know, send it around the network and you ask other validators to sign a pre-commit, which just means that they will end up attesting to that block. And depending on the particular Tendermint implementation, there's some extra reward you get for having a lot of pre-commits on your block. And so that comes back to the whole network topology topic, right? You kind of, the simplest way of seeing it is you need to be like in a data center that other people are. But then, you know, if there's a big upside to be captured, that can, of course, go a bit further still. And then you can think about, you know, how can I make sure that valid other data centers see that block more quickly than they usually would. Right? Yeah.
I had a episode with one of the Skip guys and they leaked some out on the Cosmos MEV scene. It does seem quite interesting, but I don't know how much volume is really on Cosmos.
So, okay, I think there's kind of DYDX, and then there's the rest of Cosmos, as far as the volume goes. But then DYDX behaves in a different way than, you know, like normal MEV would. It's basically trading on an order book and so on. But yeah, I mean, DYDX definitely has all of the top market makers on there. That's a very competitive platform to be. And right. Then as far as the rest of Cosmos goes, the main DEX is Osmosis. And actually, I think the Skip team has done an excellent job at kind of capturing those osmosis MEV protocol, right? So the only thing that's left is statistical arbitrage. So there's no real search, no real room for searchers that trade on-chain only.
And when we talk about the DYD MEV, the order book MEV, market makers, how do you even get to become a good market maker, a great market maker, but then also doing order book MEV? Because I think order books is now a new narrative in crypto, especially on Ethereum. So how do you kind of see the future playing out with order book MEV and how it affects everything else?
For sure, yeah. So I think to a large extent, it's an infrastructure game again. So let me just set the scene here by describing the way that DYDX works, for example, and then how we think that a market maker might think about that, right? And then, you know, like we had a grant here by DYDX to look at some ways that you can mitigate undesirable forms of MEV on an order book of the type that DYDX runs. So I'll talk a little bit about this too, but basically, you know, when we did the grant, one thing that we noticed is that people have this connotation that MEV is bad, right? So MEV is, you know, extractive per se by definition. I think that's not quite accurate, because what is even MEV, right? I mean, a market maker canceling the orders on an order book, is that MEV? I mean, sure, it might be. The way the transaction works, the way the transaction is being placed might look a lot like MEV, but really in terms of impact on the user, it's completely negligible. And the same with if you were to put a maker order on the order book, right? I mean, sure, if you're a taker, there's going to be somebody on the other side. And then if you have better information, that person is probably being adversely selected. But then if you just make sure that your maker order is in a very good place in the order book, then I think you could say that it's a net positive, right? I mean, it's additional liquidity there. Okay, so in any case, the way DYDX works is that there's a big validator set, and validators keep a copy of the order book in RAM. And then basically when they're up to propose, they would match their copy of the order book against the market orders they get, and then they would just execute it. And of course, this is, you know, it's a very new design, and there's some adverse things that could have happened, right? So in terms of what a market maker might do, if a system like that is being left unchecked, what could happen is that a market maker just forks the validator client, or basically goes and pairs with a node operator, and they would immediately have full control of the order book, and they could put their order at any place in the book, right? And that, of course, would be extremely extractive. And so the way we proposed offsetting that, and we actually worked with the Skip guys on that, is to have a couple of nodes placed around the network, which build like an aggregate neutral view of the order book. And then if any validator, in terms of what it ends up executing on chain, you know, like consistently is mismatched versus the neutral view of the order book, they would be up for slashing. And so in our experience, this has worked pretty well at deterring, you know, like really undesirable behavior by market makers. And then beyond that, in terms of how a market maker would optimize benignly, one easy thing to do is to co-locate with validators, right? And so in the DYDX case, for example, all validators are in Tokyo. Yeah, everybody is, well, I mean, not all of them are. People can still choose to run in other places.
Yeah, yeah.
But it happens that like 80% of the nodes, or maybe even more, are in Tokyo. And the reason for that is the elephant in the room, right? It's basically where Binance is deployed.
Yeah.
And so what a market maker might do is they would be in Tokyo as well. You know, I mean, maybe they even do something like spin up AWS instances and try to ping validators and try to kind of get into the same box as a big validator, right? And I think the way you would do it is you basically just go down the list by voting power and you try to be as close as possible to these validators. And then, yeah, you send them there. You send them your transactions basically with minimum network latency. And that kind of gets you pretty close to what the experience on a centralized exchange would be.
I don't know why they would want to mitigate MEV though, because isn't MEV on an order book really just filling in the orders?
Yeah, I feel, okay, so I think MEV, if somebody were to say MEV is like a way of thinking about the way your transaction is placed, it's being done like in a very competitive.
Well, I guess you could with order book MEV is, since you know something is being filled and then it executes, you could like theoretically sandwich that by buying something before that and then filling it and then doing the end of the sandwich. Because if it all lands in what do you call it? If it all gets sent to a builder anyway, it's just like a normal transaction at that point. It's just a normal swap then. You just got to identify it, and it's just a normal, you know, sandwich at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, something like that could happen. I mean, I think one thing that's okay. How would people defend against that? I think the market maker would just you would make your spread would be pretty wide, right? And then kind of what people take, sure. This is why it's very important that cancellations are very efficient, because if cancellations are slow, people are kind of open to being adversely selected all the time. But then if you have quick cancellations and you're mostly a maker and not really a taker, you're usually fine. And then, you know, if like a place is less sophisticated, I think they would be running a higher spread, and then they would just be making commensurately like less profit, right? Because they get filled less often.
The market maker doing faster cancellations, is what you're saying?
You mean versus an ordinary user? Yeah, I think that would be fair to say. Just because, I mean, it's not something that's enshrined in the architecture, but it's definitely something that people are optimizing for.
What are your thoughts on like Uniswap V4 then? Because that's just an order book as well.
Yeah, I mean, I really haven't looked too much into Uniswap V4 beyond the RFQ side of things. When you say it's an order book, like, is it literally an order book with make orders, take orders, and so on?
Actually, is it Uniswap V4? I think it's Uniswap V4 is everyone is able to create their own DEX. So instead of like creating a liquidity pool, you know, there's a factory of liquidity pools. It's like a factory of straight up DEXs. So then it's no longer one single DEX like Uni V2 or V3. It's now everyone has their own specialized DEX of their own niches and unique kind of attributes, and all the liquidity is spread between them all. So it's like a hyper fragmentation of liquidity. But then I think the Uniswap X is what I meant. I think it is quite literally an order book. I think it's the most active on Ethereum, actually.
Really? Okay. Yeah, I haven't looked much into it. I just like the extent of my knowledge of this Uniswap version is I looked a little bit into books, and then I looked at the RFQ systems they have there.
Yeah.
And yeah. Kind of tried to understand how that compares to Caldwell and so on. But I haven't looked at the order book component of it.
Yeah, order books seem interesting. Yes. I think the Solana stuff is quite interesting, but the overhead, which I think deters everyone, like you can't really test easy on Solana. Like the tooling isn't as far as Ethereum. There's no, I guess, equivalent of Forge on Ethereum. So it kind of stops a lot of people jumping in. And then also gathering all the data is not trivial at all. There's no streamlined ways of doing things yet, which just kind of, you know, it's a big ramp. It's like learning a new language.
Yeah. I tried to develop a little bit on Solana. And, I mean, it hasn't been the most pleasant developer experience, let's put it this way.
I think it's a core thing in any new ecosystem. I tried to do this contract work on, I think it was Hedera, that blockchain. But like, oh man, was that the worst experience I've ever had? Like I had to turn down the job because I tried it. And then I realized I just couldn't do it because there was no visualization to anything. I couldn't fork the chain. I couldn't do any of that, which seems very trivial, but it is very important. Which really forking is just, you know, getting, just seeing like, let's say you have a contract on mainnet, you call a view function, you get that data, you cache it, and that's kind of how a fork works for that state. But you also need, like, if you want to do a past fork, then you would need some kind of history node where you can grab a state at a past block, obviously. But yeah, validation seems quite interesting. But with the Ethereum validators, since there's so much competition, is there a way actually to optimize to become a validator more often than someone else? Or is it really just random?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. Okay, so I haven't thought about it in these terms. But let's see what elements would be relevant here, right? So, okay, one would be the random selection algorithm, whether that's truly random or not. And then the other thing is how much stake you have. I don't have an opinion on whether selection is truly random or not. I would probably operate on the assumption that it is. I think you can get some of the benefits that would look similar to being selected more often by pooling capital. So specifically what I mean here is, for example, MEV rewards are run super high variance, right? Mm. And so you can win the lottery, or you can do very badly. Right, you can basically perform below what you would expect your MEV to be if you just run a single ballot, just depending on when you end up proposing. And then, so one thing you can do is, if you pool a lot of validators, you can smooth things like MEV out, and that probably has some beneficial properties just in terms of, you know, where you are on the risk reward curve. But as far as being like explicitly selected more often, well, I hope not. I hope not.
Yeah, because like if you think about the selective algorithm for choosing someone, and thinking about randomness, or otherwise known as like the definitive pattern or predictability in information, well, the lack of it. But you have to code that in to the software for it to happen, though. So there must be predictability if you're writing it in, right? Or maybe I'm just very naive in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, my colleague on the research team, Umberto, he's a PhD in cosmology, so that seems like a question that he would be interested in, just in terms of randomness and very large data sets, but we haven't looked into it, though.
Okay, yeah, because now I've recently stumbled across this dilemma with everything and just randomness in general. And now I think nothing is truly random, which is not fun.
Yeah, you know, as they used to generate random numbers back. I mean, first of all, I think Cloudflare, part of the input to the random number generator is the way that lava lamps move, right? So they basically...
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can see it on YouTube. They basically have a bunch of cameras on like a huge cabinet of lava lamps. And apparently that's about as random as you can get.
So that's
one of the inputs to the random number generator. And then back in the day, actually, when people needed random numbers for experiments, before you could do things like atmospheric... Yeah, noise or whatever. People would generate random numbers by watching the way that a fish would move, right? So there would be like an aquarium, and in the middle of the aquarium there would be like a line, and every time the fish crosses the line, you basically increment the counter or something.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. That's definitely not random, but you know.
Yeah, like if you take everything down to like how we create these generators. There's always something, like the inputs of the lava lamp, from like just observing, it doesn't look random, but then there's some, maybe it's like, okay, you have 20 lava lamps, and then you take a snapshot every 20 seconds, and like depending on how many blobs are down versus up, you choose one number. I don't know, but it's still not really random, because you're going through a sequence to get that number.
Yeah, I'm not sure how precisely they do it. And then again, it's one input, right? So there might be just a thing around correlation. My guess is the lava lamp doesn't really correlate with many other things.
Yeah, like you wouldn't be able to observe that lava lamp if you're just using the API.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the lava lamp thing, I mean, I definitely think it's pretty funny. If I was there and I was watching the lava lamp, would I think that it's random?
This is our randomness generator.
It's definitely quite unusual. I mean, I guess as humans, we're just extremely bad at estimating whether something is random or not.
Yeah, I think it's really... If you cannot see or observe it, then I guess it is random, depending on how complex it is in the back. Like, the lava lamp is great, because you cannot just, like, at a given moment, you don't know when the blobs are, like, what position. So, like, reverse engineering it will be extremely, just super hard.
I imagine it is. I mean, to be honest, the last time I've interacted with a lava lamp was probably in the early 2000s, but...
Oh, I have one staring right at me right now.
Okay.
I'm trying to predict the randomness right now.
I mean, that doesn't look like random. I mean, probably kind of.
I mean, like, all the blobs go to like one or like the top or the bottom, and then shortly after they like shoot back out to like the middle. So I don't know. It's like a little delay.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that could be like a chain link oracle or something.
Guys, if you need a chain link oracle, hit me up. I got a lot.
Incredibly neutral lava lamp.
Exactly. Until I turn the power off, then it's over.
So I think the whole thing with randomness and so on, okay. I mean, also, I mean, what amount of data would you need to be able to say, is there some really small effect here or not, right? It's probably talking, you know, like multiple years.
I think it's always useful to just look at it, see if it is super fucking random. Because if it's not random, then you have determinability. And if your whole business is based on validation, then, you know, maybe you can just determine whether you're going to be valid or not. And I think if you can determine that as well, then you could override PBS entirely. And if people make like straight up partnerships with a predetermined validator, a specific block, then you could just bypass the PBS and then cancel everyone else's block, only use yours, and then it's validated. So then it is, and you can, if it is like a block that abides by consensus, I don't know, I think that's pretty powerful, but it just depends how random that is.
Can you imagine the shitstorm?
I can't imagine the shitstorm. It would just be Solana at that point.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty intense. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a question that I think we would not be totally adverse looking into. But then I think if you found something there, it would probably take the form of a paper and not an active optimization.
And maybe a banger tweet.
Yeah, it would be a good tweet. I would have to think about that one. It would have to be a good one. Yeah.
It would be a banger tweet. That's the real value in that. But man, Michael, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Appreciate your time talking about validators. You know, the PBS. Cosmos, Solana. Looking forward to the future papers, my friend. And any alpha? When new paper?
Yeah. Well, first of all, likewise, I think that was a very entertaining conversation, so thanks for that. But a new paper. We'll have the dashboard coming, which is our view of the auction, so maybe people will find that interesting as well. And then in terms of a new paper, I think the whole pre-confirmation space is pretty interesting. And specifically how validators would go about selecting whether to commit to including a certain transaction. So we're thinking a little bit about this, but it's still early. Hopefully we can get it out sometime around ECC or slightly before even.
Okay, perfect. Well, hopefully this will be out by then. I'm sure it will be. And until then, I'll talk to you soon, hopefully.